Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here in the home of the 2016 Baltimore Mayoral Debate, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. This is a segment from the Steiner Show archives, so we're not taking calls, but share your thoughts at talk@steinershow.org or tweet us at Mark Steiner. We are joined this hour. I haven't seen him in a while since his last book, when I guess it was 7 years ago.
Not quite that long ago. About 4 years
ago. 4 years ago. I'm bad with time frames. It was Geography of Bliss, which is really a great book, and we really enjoyed our conversation then. Eric Weiner is a former correspondent for NPR, New York Times. He's written for many places across the journalistic spectrum. And his latest book is Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. And Eric Weiner, welcome back.
Thanks.
To Baltimore, your hometown.
It is. I'm thrilled to be back here.
It's good to have you here. And you keep seeking in your books.
I know. I'm so restless. Why can't I stay still?
Before you were finding bliss and where they have bliss.
I needed to find a topic bigger than happiness, and the only thing I could find was God, I guess. I don't know what I'm going to do after this. I guess I am a seeker, and I do my seeking on the road for the most part. What I try to do is travel writing, but it's not sort of just your typical travel writing, which tends to be kind of a meander through the countryside or wherever. I'm traveling with a purpose. I'm looking for answers to questions. I'm looking for something.
And why this one? I mean, I understood happiness because you went through different societies that really wrestled with happiness and tried to make happiness part of the equation of their existence. But why this one?
Well, I'll tell you, when I was researching the Geography of Bliss, my last book, I kept stumbling across this one statistic, and that is this. Religious people are happier than secular people. This is pretty consistent in every survey. And, I made brief mention in the Geography of Bliss, but I didn't dive into it very deeply. And I've been wondering about it. I asked my friends who tend to be atheists, you know, why is that? Why would religious people be happier than the secular? And of course, they snip back that, well, ignorance is bliss.
But it's deeper than that.
Well, it is deeper than that. And I wanted to find out, you know, what is it about the religious that makes them happier? And really, this is, Mark, a more personal book. There is a brief story about how this came about. This was shortly after I had finished the first book, tremendous relief after tremendous pressure, and I developed this sharp shooting abdominal pain about a week later. And I tried to pretend it wasn't really there, but it wouldn't go away. So eventually I did go to the emergency room, and they did a bunch of tests. The doctor came back and declared that there was something, and I quote, funky on my CT scan. Never great.
That was a medical term.
It is, apparently. I've heard other people report doctors saying that there's something funky here or funky there. So now I'm really scared because there's evidence of that. You know, I'm not just being a hypochondriac here, that something's wrong. And I'm scared. And a nurse walks in, picks up on my fear, which was pretty palpable, leans down and whispers in my ear the following words: "Have you found your God yet?" And that was her question. And that just sent my fear just off the charts. I'm pretty sure that is not standard operating procedure at most hospitals, not even one called Holy Cross. Long story short, I was not dying. It just turned out to be a very severe case of intestinal gas. I'm released from the embarrassing but true. I'm discharged from the hospital. And there's that question, though. Have you found your God yet? Here I was in my mid-40s. Secular. I was raised nominally Jewish, but really we were gastronomical Jews. It was all about the food and very little about God. And I think that's typical for a lot of Jews in this country. It's typical for a lot of people in this country. But for whatever reason, middle age or this brush with gas or whatever it was, I felt compelled to answer the nurse's question and to answer it pretty much in the only way I know how, which is by traveling far and wide and diving deep.
And it was interesting. This is a little aside, but I heard that a fellow talk show host, who's a friend, Michael Eric Dyson, saw that page in the book and said, when the woman whispered to you, "Have I found my God yet?" He said to you, "Was it a black woman?" Right?
How do you know that? That is true. He said that, and I said to him, "How did you know that?" And he's like, "No white woman would ask a question like that. That was a sister, wasn't it?" And I said, Yeah, it was. I think she was from the Caribbean. I believe she had a slight accent. And yeah, okay. I'm feeling a bit flustered here, but that's true.
I love that. That was great. But so when you went off to do this journey, and you picked some very strange religions and some very fundamental religions.
Yeah, I tried to. I mean, simply narrowing down the list is tricky. How many religions do you think there are in the world, Mark?
There are thousands.
Yeah, most people would say dozens or hundreds. In fact, there are 9,945.
That's right.
Yeah, and with new ones being formed all the time. So we live in a time of tremendous spiritual and religious choice, perhaps more than any other time in history. We are free to choose our religion, and we have this tremendous choice before us. And unlike in ancient times, we are not likely to be, you know, stoned for choosing the wrong one or one that's not considered acceptable. But, you know, choice works both ways. The French have a saying that too much choice kills the choice. And if you've ever, like, frozen on the in the supermarket in front of the breakfast cereal aisle, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, yes.
Where to turn, what to do. I sort of narrowed down the list, eliminating religions that didn't accept converts, for instance, such mm-hmm. as the Zoroastrians. I eliminated ones that struck me as too narrow, such as Hungarian folk religion. Being neither Hungarian nor particularly folksy, I crossed that one off the list. Others struck me as too broad, and I realize this may offend some listeners, but I eliminated the Unitarian Universalists.
It would offend one of my producers who's a Unitarian.
Have I offended her? Okay, yeah. because that struck me as overly broad. But I've heard from the Unitarians who were not happy with my crossing them off the list or what I had to say about them.
She's looking at you now.
Okay. But the thing is, if you really piss off the Unitarians, the consequences are not that great. They lit a candle of concern on my behalf, but they did not come after me. And then eventually, and seriously here, I came up with these eight religions, a sort of cross-section of the religious world. Some monotheistic, like Christianity and Islam, Judaism. Some polytheistic, like Wicca. And some atheistic. There are atheistic religions, such as Buddhism and Taoism. Religion in every sense of the word, but they don't believe in a god or a higher power, a supreme being.
A higher being that hears you.
Yeah, they believe in something, that there is something else, whether it's the Buddha mind or just the way, which is what the Tao means, literally.
Right.
But it's not God in terms of the way we think of it, which is, as Alan Watts, the British philosopher, put it, the cosmic male parent. That tends to be the Judeo-Christian view of God. And that is just one view. There are many others.
So this question, I found the book really interesting, and the quest you went on. I have to tell you, when I first opened the book and read the first chapter on the Sufis, when you
yes.
I saw, and you went to this place in California.
Sufi camp. Yeah.
And I went, oh, no. Is he going to do a Sufi thing and just talk to a bunch of American hippies? That's my first thought was. But then, of course, you didn't. You went to Turkey.
Well, I started off with the American hippies. First of all, Sufi camp. That's great, isn't it? But it turned out to be considerably more camp than Sufi, you know? I mean, it was a lot of deep-fried hippy-dippy types. And, you know, it was fun, but it was this sort of hodgepodge of different beliefs and faiths. You know, it was a little bit of Sufism, but it was also a little bit of Japanese tea ceremony, Buddhist sutra, a very nice Jewish Sabbath I experienced at Sufi camp. And it struck me as sort of emblematic of what's wrong with the New Age movement, and that is that it is just sort of these things cobbled together without people really understanding the component parts. And you get this kind of mushy result. And so I decided at that point, early on in my journey, that I was going to go as much as possible to the source of these religions. So for Sufism, that meant Turkey.
That meant Turkey.
Yeah.
And you did meet Bilal, who seemed to be a fairly decent guy at that.
Yeah,
at that,
I mean, I don't mean to diss everything about the New Age movement, because there's a lot to be said for it, and there are genuine seekers there. And Bilal is someone, though, who converted to Islam. Now, there are Sufis in this country who don't consider themselves Muslims.
Right.
Most Muslims outside of this country find that unbelievable. They think that if you're going to be a Sufi, you have to be a Muslim first.
And Sufis also, as you describe in the book, when you went to Turkey, the Sufis have their own hard way to go inside the Muslim religion.
Yeah, they're the outcast. I mean, right. They are the wayward
son. They're
sons.
Everywhere. There are tens of millions of them.
They're everywhere from, you know, Morocco to Indonesia.
Pakistan.
To very big in
Huge
Pakistan,
in Pakistan
and in India. And they are looked at askance. Someone explained it to me this way, that they are viewed as sort of the snake-handling Pentecostals of the Ozarks of the Muslim world.
But they're not.
They're not. they're actually great. I actually really like the Sufis. They are filled with heart. They are, in a way, the opposite of at least what I thought Islam was, a very sort of arid, rigorous, serious religion. The Sufis are great fun, and they're all about heart and divine love.
I mean, when the going into Turkey... Going into Turkey, it was interesting. First of all, I learned for the first time what the word Istanbul meant, which I didn't know until I read the book, and which was fascinating. And we're going to jump into Turkey with Eric Weiner and what he found in Turkey and with the Sufis, and what heart talk means. I want to encourage you all to join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. To join in this conversation with Eric Weiner, who's written the book Man Seeks God and My Flirtations with the Divine by Eric Weiner, 410-319-8888. And we will surf through together Sufism, his trek to Nepal to discover Buddhism, his trek to New York and the Bronx to live with the Franciscans, and a very strange religion. We'll embark upon called The Rails, and they have a short chapter, and that's not an accent that they have a short chapter. 410-319-8888. Feel better?
Yes, I did. Okay. brief coughing attack there, good. But I feel much better.
I'm glad you're good. Yeah. I didn't want you to, this whole discussion of God and religion to send you off someplace else.
I get all choked up talking about it, literally.
So, all right, so you go to Istanbul.
Yes, home of the dervishes, the whirling dervishes.
As a Confucian.
Confucianist. Someone deeply confused.
Right.
And have you ever seen the whirling dervishes?
I have seen whirling dervishes.
It's amazing. It is this combination of very active practice because they're whirling, they're spinning on their axis. And it's also very contemplative at the same time. And I witnessed a performance just outside of Istanbul, and I was amazed at the look of sheer joy and peace on the face of this one semazan, that's what they're called, the performers. It was a woman, and I wanted to do that.
And your guide was a woman. Your guide was a Sufi woman.
Yes, yes. Right. Her name was Dilek. She was also a tour guide in her real life, so it was perfect. And I said to Dilek, look, I want to turn. Can you help me turn? And she found a teacher for me. And it wasn't easy because Sufism is still somewhat underground in Turkey. Ataturk, when he took power, banned all of the Sufi orders, and later they allowed some of them to practice. And here I am, this, you know, gastronomical Jew, Confucianist, on this, you know, crazy search for God and spirituality. And so it wasn't easy, but my friend Dilek found me a teacher. And it was this woman with fiery red hair, with the look and demeanor of an East German gymnastics coach. She was tough. And we tried. I tried. For hours, probably, to turn, and failed for most of the time, but did have a brief moment where I succeeded and achieved, I guess psychologists would call it, a state of flow, you know, when you lose track of time and everything falls into place. And ultimately, I think that's what these spiritual practices are about, is a kind of forgetting of ourself, a dropping of the ego for a few moments at least.
And you also journey through these with books, most places you went. You had these reams of books to kind of...
I love books. I mean, Joseph Campbell, the great teacher of and student of mythology, was once asked what his spiritual practice was, and he said, I underline books. And that's me, and maybe that's you and others as well. You know, but I realized the problem is I'd rather read about a spiritual experience than have one. So while I did read a lot about each religion, I made an effort to get out of my head as much as possible.
And they wanted you to get out of your head. Almost every place you went, not well, many of the places you sojourned through, whether it was the Sufis or the Taoists or
they told
the
me
Franciscans.
Put down the books.
Right.
I met a Sufi sheikh in Istanbul, and I asked him, how should I read Rumi? Now, Rumi is, of course, the great mystical poet. He said, don't read Rumi.
Right.
I was like, whoa. I mean, this was like a Catholic priest saying, don't read St. Augustine or someone like that. I mean, it was remarkable, but I think what he was trying to convey to me is get out of your head. You only understand Rumi when you stop reading Rumi. It's this contradiction. And the spiritual seeking is filled with contradictions. And some of them are nonsense, and some of them are contradictions that ultimately make sense if you can get there.
I mean, one of the things it's cute on one level, but it's real on another. When Rumi says there's a hidden sweetness in stomach's emptiness, and almost many of the paths that you kind of visited, spiritual paths you visited, there's this idea that comes up over and over again about an empty stomach puts you closer to the spirit.
Right, think about it. Almost every religion, you know, whether it's Lent for Catholics or fasting during Ramadan.
14 fast days in the Jewish religion?
Yeah. And there's the... Probably the religion that takes us to the greatest extreme is the Jains in India. And they have a practice, somewhat controversial, of even fasting unto death.
Right.
Which you've heard of that.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is, that's extreme. But there's something about not having a full stomach that lends itself to mystical experiences.
And somebody, I was with people the other week who are... who follow their Native American religions, Arapaho friends who are here in town, and they talk often about they go for 3-4-day fasts.
Right.
And to sit alone and then come back with a 3-day fast. It is in almost every spiritual path. Fasting
is
part of
finding. Which is hard for people like me because I love food and I love eating.
That's why you're supposed to do it.
I know. But it's so hard. And then I always found on Yom Kippur that, you know, the day of Jewish Day of Atonement, I'm fasting and all I'm thinking about is food. You know? So I guess you get past that. And there are these similarities across all these spiritual traditions. And one of them is fasting.
Right.
Another one is motion. There's often motion, whether it's Jewish davening or the circumambulations that Buddhists do around a stupa. All kinds of things. Tai Chi or Qigong, part of Taoist practice.
Walking meditation among Buddhists
as well. Walking meditation. We think of the spiritual seeker as sort of just sitting on a mountaintop, immobile, meditating,
right.
But actually they are often quite active.
So let's go to the phones. We have people calling in at 410-319-8888. We'll get them on the air here. Hold on as soon as I get their names up there. I should not see them. Oh, we're ready for one. Prince in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello?
You're on the air.
Oh, this is Clarence. I'm sorry.
Oh, Clarence. It says Prince on my screen. I'm sorry. Clarence, how are you?
I'm fine. And you, sir?
Good to hear from you.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to ask you, Gessen, doing his research on his book, is there any one religion that he could speculate or make an assumption that would be the oldest and everything else would be a derivative of? And also, did you find that any of your work because Dr. Joseph Campbell did something called Myths and Legends, which I found to be, you know, a great documentary. How much of your book do you think verifies or you know, more or less... brings truth to what he speculated in that, what he found to be true in his documentary, if you've seen it or know of it?
Wow, some good questions there. The oldest religion. I was struck by how just about every religion I encountered appeared to be a hybrid of some kind, that there were similarities. You know, Jesus lived some 500 years after the Buddha was born, and some scholars have speculated that he was influenced by Buddhist teaching because there were Buddhist monasteries as close as Alexandria, Egypt, to what is now Israel.
Right.
But people in religions, if they're focused on being Catholic or Jewish or whatever, they tend not to see the influences of other faiths. Everyone likes to think that their religion is unique and is one of a kind. But clearly they were influenced by others. The oldest, the Zoroastrians are pretty old. They're known as Parsis in India, and they go back many, many thousands of years. But I don't know if you could point to one sort of meta faith.
Maybe if you talk about religion that's still surviving today, I would think maybe two. Probably be the Vedic Hindus,
yes,
and the Zoroastrians.
Yeah.
They would probably be the two oldest religions that extant that still exist on the planet.
I think that's probably true. And they have branched off into many others. And yet they still exist. They're still Zoroastrians today, Parsis in India. In the Vedic traditions, there's the Vedanta Society of America. You could probably I know there's one in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
There's probably one up here. You can go and study the Vedas. It's kind of amazing if you think about it that they've survived for that long. The second part of his question, I'm familiar with Joseph Campbell's work, not that particular
film.
Well,
I guess you didn't deal with it in your book very much, but the whole question of how the universality of you talk about Jung here and there, but the universality of the myth of the stories that run through religions, and they're very similar in many ways. You even found some of that in your roamings.
Yeah, there are similarities in especially in the sort of the stories of the founders of these religions, whether it was the Buddha or whoever. They often go through trials and tribulations. It's never easy. A religion is never formed like, everything was going really well in my life, and then I decided, I'd started a dot-com startup, and I decided to start a religion. And then, it's always through trials and tribulations. The Buddha suffered tremendously. He began life, of course, as a pampered prince, basically, and then realized that suffering was the way of human beings. It was unavoidable. And then he went off and he nearly died attempting to practice a really strict form of asceticism where he barely ate anything.
And I love your Buddhist chapter, which I want to jump into next. We've been stuck on Sufism for the first time. We'll move out of there. Though there is a great line that you have in here when someone says, either appear as you be or be as you appear. And that struck you.
Yeah. I believe that was Rumi.
That was Rumi.
And, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around that one. Can you help me?
Either appear
as you be or be as you appear.
Well, we could take the rest hour talking about.
we could do your programming for the rest of 2012.
They could do that forever and never stop.
Tear up the schedule and let's. here's the thing. I don't fully know what that means, but it struck me as profound. And I stumbled across a lot of things like that, that I just sensed that there's some wisdom here, but I couldn't quite figure out what it was. And this is the thing about spiritual journeying and writing about spiritual journeys is it's really tricky because you want to be wise and profound, but sometimes you just don't get it. And I try to be very honest here, and I hope you picked up on that.
Yeah, yeah.
If it wasn't working for me, I was honest about that. I'm not saying that this was nonsense, but if I'm doing this practice or that practice and I don't get it, I will say.
But it seems that what worked for you, to me. And by the way, as you just said, I would think that one of the things that means, that quote, because I've heard it before, is that reading Rumi, and Coleman Barks has been on the show many times, is that you have to be content with the place you're in, whether it's one you've created in your head, whether it's coming out of your soul, it's the place you're in.
Yeah, no, that's true. At Sufi camp, I met a man named Wali Ali, great name. He said to me, you can't be any wiser than you are. And I think that is in itself wise because oftentimes we reach, we want to be enlightened, so we sort of go through the motions pretending we are. But, you start where you are, and you can't pretend you're in Paris when you're in Baltimore.
Exactly.
Yeah,
you can't. Unless even in a tight little French restaurant in Baltimore, you can't pretend you're in Paris.
In Baltimore.
But one of the things that seems to run through this for you, and you'll tell me I'm wrong maybe, but is that whether it was the Sufis or the Taoists or the Kabbalists in Israel, what seemed to get you was this sense of mysticism, the sense of mystery that wound its way through some of these spiritual paths.
You're not wrong. You're right. and it's something that is beyond reason, that is not rational. And we tend to view anything that is not reasonable or rational as bad. in today's modern world. We think the problem with the world is that there is a lack of reason. But every religion and every spiritual tradition tells you that there is something that you can attain that's beyond the rational mind. I sense that that is true. I've had just the very slightest glimmers of that, but I think there is some truth to that. You know, it's just like some societies believe that thinking is bad. The Thais have an expression, don't think too much. The Inuit also believe that thinking can be a sign of mental illness. In which case, college campuses are filled with really sick people. But I think we've all experienced that on some level, even by having a delicious meal or tasting a good wine. You're experiencing something in a way that's not entirely rational.
So what is it that when you went to Nepal to find the Buddhist truth?
Yes.
You seem to found at first kind of a very depressing religion. And you always tend towards depression yourself, obviously.
Right.
But you
always suffering. That's
always
the first
suffering.
Of the Four Noble Truths. Always suffering. I thought, wow, here's a religion that gets it, that gets me, you know.
But then you found out.
Well, yeah. I mean, people hear that and they think, well, Buddhists are real bummers, always suffering. But, of course, the other three of the Four Noble Truths is, well, there's a reason for that suffering, sort of excessive desire. And there's a potential cure for that suffering. You know, which is essentially a practice of meditation and trying to get beyond desire. So the Buddha very much saw himself as a kind of physician, diagnosing the human condition, always suffering. A reason for the diagnosis is excessive desire, just crazy out of control desire, and that there's a cure. Here's your prescription. Go meditate, basically. And that's what the Buddhists say. They don't say, here, believe in this. They say, go try this, investigate, try it, see if it works for you. And that's why I think it's immensely appealing to a lot of people all over the world, especially in this country.
We can take a very brief break and come right back. Eric Weiner is our guest. His latest book is Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine, as you travel the earth, meeting many religions and people in them and spending time in them. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Take a short break. Stay with us. On our way to break, I want to remind you to join us on Thursday, March the 10th at 7 p.m. at the Carl J. Murphy Fine Arts Center at Morgan State University for Baltimore's mayoral debate, co-sponsored by WEAA, City Paper, The Afro, and The Spokesman. The theme for the event is Ask, Listen, Vote, Solutions and Strategies for the Future. That's Thursday, March the 10th at 7 p.m. More information, WEAA.org. I'm Mark Steiner, right here on the home of the 2016 Baltimore Mayoral Debate, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. This hour, we're listening back to my conversation with author and former NPR foreign correspondent Eric Weiner about his book, Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. He was a presence in public radio for many years, covering wars and many other things, and written for many publications. His last book was The Geography of Bliss, where he traveled the world looking for societies where the question of bliss and happiness is important in those societies. And he did the same here in many ways in Man Seeks God. We talked during the break about William James, because he's all through this. You're always quoting him all through the book and referring back to him.
I like William James.
Obviously.
William James lived about 100 years ago. He's the lesser-known brother of the novelist Henry James. But he was a remarkable man. He was a philosopher and a psychologist when that field was just taking off. And his best-known work is a heavy tome known as The Varieties of Religious Experience. And what's interesting about this book is that its title alone gives it away, The Varieties of not of Religious Theology or Religious Rituals, but Religious Experience. That's what James was interested in. How do people experience religion? And it was an academic book, but it also had this pathos throughout it, in that you can just sense that James had this sort of admiration and curiosity about these people who reported these mystical experiences. And I don't know if you would see a book like that today by an academic. He kept these people somewhat at arm's length. He wasn't a religious man himself. He wanted to be, but he said he couldn't pray. He felt silly. But you definitely sense that, he wished he could experience what these people were experiencing. He was sort of my guide throughout the book. He also was a kind of depressive person, much like myself. Suffered from depression on and off throughout his life, as I have, as I do. He was, I guess, in modern vernacular, you would say he was high maintenance. My wife tells me I'm much the same.
But she stays with you.
She does, because it's interesting. He was sort of the first person in this country, perhaps in the world, to study religion academically, but also with a great deal of, if not empathy, then sympathy and whatever the word is there, yeah.
So when you – journey through these places, let's then look at – when you went to Nepal, I found that there was a very interesting chapter for me. the place you discovered, which was the center where the giant marshmallow was.
Yeah, all right.
And then we're going to start there. Then we'll talk about this other guy that you met.
Okay, well, the giant marshmallow is actually a Buddhist stupa. Looked like a giant marshmallow.
Well, you described it as that.
That's what it looks like. It's in a place called Bodhnath, which used to be a village outside of Kathmandu. It's been sort of swallowed up by greater Kathmandu now. And it's a remarkable place in that, because normally when you go to places with religious shrines and relics, they tend to be kind of dead. You know, the whatever spiritual energy was there is long since gone. But the Bodhnath, the stupa there, the giant marshmallow, was very much alive. Every morning at 5 a.m., Buddhist pilgrims and just ordinary Buddhists are circling the stupa. And there are all these shops and restaurants that have opened up all around it so that you can sit on the balcony of a restaurant sipping a very nice Pinot Noir and watching people become enlightened down below. I've never seen anything quite like it, the amazing mixture of the sacred and the profane. And that's where I sort of planted myself for a while.
How long were you there,
Paul? I was there for about a month, and I enjoyed it immensely. I mean, I would get up at 5 a.m. and circle the stupa with the Buddhist, and that's the thing about Buddhism. Anyone can just join in. No one's checking your Buddhist credentials at the door. You just get up early and start circling, go round and round. And you can go 5 times or you can go 50 times. It's up to you.
I love the part where you were trying to find somebody to talk to, and you found Wayne.
Well, I was trying to find a Tibetan
right.
Lama to
I know,
teach
right.
me.
I said
meditation.
You found Wayne.
Yeah, and I couldn't find one. And everyone said that all the lamas were in California, apparently, teaching people there. So finally someone suggested Wayne.
They all seem to be Americans. Wayne, Mateo.
Well, I'm drawn to people, to converts. I'm drawn to people who have really converted to these faiths, who can speak my language still. For instance, James Hopkins, a friend of mine in Kathmandu, former investment banker, made a bucket of money so that by the time he was 43, he didn't have to work another day in his life, and actually quit, moved to Kathmandu, and is essentially a full-time Buddhist there. But I can relate to him, not the buckets of money part, but the world from which he comes from. He comes from, you know, this area, and he speaks my language culturally. So I found that the converts, often the American converts, were good interlopers. They could explain these religions to me. And I also spent time with people who were native to the religion as well.
You did. No, you did.
I mean, I met a real Tibetan Lama. And this was kind of a big deal. You know, this is someone who has apparently stared down Cher, or so goes the legend. You know, he just put her in her place, apparently. And he was kind of intimidating presence, and I had like 1 minute to meet with him. And I met with him, and he said, well, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm kind of shopping for God. That was the sort of working idea for my project. And he looked very disgusted. He said, I don't like this. I said, well, I'm not shopping. I'm sort of looking for God. And he still looked disgusted. And I realized it wasn't the shopping part that he found a bit limited, as he said, but the God part. For Buddhists, it's bigger than God. You know, and the Buddhists consider an enlightened human to be more admirable than a God, in fact.
And you did find in the end, I think you came to a sort of conclusion that this was not a depressing, it's not a religion that was about.
It's not. It is, you know, the ultimate goal of Buddhism is enlightenment, is nirvana, is actually getting out of this cycle of death and birth and rebirth, and achieving a kind of bliss that you and I can only imagine. I did find it a bit clinical. Now, if you've grown up in the Judeo-Christian tradition and you believe in a forgiving God, there is no such thing in Buddhism. It's just you and your monkey mind, as the Buddhists call it. You know,
that doesn't let you meditate. Your monkey mind.
That doesn't let you meditate.
Right.
And to me, at least, it's always struck me as a bit clinical. And I realize, though, that's what appeals. That's its appeal for a lot of people. Is you're not required to believe in anything.
I have to jump ahead a minute here, but I do want to talk about the Franciscans and get to the Kabbalists and your trip with the Taoists. But why did you – I know what you said in the book, but why did you go – why did you pick and describe who they are, the Raelists? What made you want to go
– Raelians.
Raelians.
Yeah.
Because you described – you said in the beginning of the book how you didn't want to go to cults.
Right.
Right? But this is not a cult?
Well, I defined cults not by their numbers – or their newness or their strangeness, but by coercive tactics. That's why certain religions, which shall remain nameless, I did not investigate because I consider their tactics coercive. The Raelians are not coercive unless you consider fun as a form of coercion. I admit it's a bit out there. The Raelians are just to – because most people are probably not familiar with them.
They are
the world's largest UFO-based religion. And there's more than one. And their beliefs, in a nutshell, are that we were created not by God, but by these aliens called the Elohim 25,000 years ago, and that they created us essentially for one purpose, which was to have an incredible amount of fun while we're here, often sensual and sexual fun. And I got there to their annual sort of convention in Las Vegas, of course. And
I love that.
I was struck first by how sane everybody seemed. I didn't meet anyone who appeared crazy. I met lots of PhDs in economics and scientific types, medical doctors, and an awful lot of former Catholics. I mean, the religion is largely a reaction, I think, to Catholicism. So they've taken Catholicism and turned it on its head, really. And it raises an interesting question, though, Mark. Is pleasure, and let's be upfront here, sexual pleasure, sensual pleasure, is that not compatible with religion, or are they compatible? And why, when we hear about a religion that actually promotes fun and pleasure, do we consider it not serious? And in that chapter, I explore that question. Ultimately, I conclude the problem with the Raelians are not their wacky ideas about UFOs, but their ideas about fun and pleasure. We don't want our religions to just be fun. You know, we can get fun in Vegas. We can get fun at Disney World. We actually want it to be hard. That's why if you look at all these religious choices out there in America today, the most popular ones tend to be kind of hard. Did you know that Calvinism, of all things, is enjoying a resurgence in America? And Buddhism is hard if you've ever tried to sit and meditate. I mean, I think we want to be stretched. We don't want a religion that's just all fun and games.
And most of the people that you – those are the religions you sat with – do that. I mean, that's what they did.
That's what who did?
The religions you sat with, you visited.
Yeah.
It was about stretching.
It was about hard work, whether it's taking, you know, vows of chastity, as the Franciscans do, or meditating like the Buddhists, or fasting. Yeah, it's about doing the hard work.
Let me go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Eric Weiner is with us. His book, Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. Let's see. And John in Gwin Oak, you're on the air.
Yes, I just like to ask the speaker. I thought about him when he said he went to the doctor because he had a pain in his stomach.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know, what was the doctor's prognosis? In other words, what was his problem? And then he would come with diagnose, and then he would come with a prognosis to tell him what to do. And in the Bible, it says, Jesus said, if you're sick, go to the physician. So my thought is, if he's going to all these different religions, are they physicians?
Hmm.
I mean, let's put it this way. Are they healthcare professionals?
Hmm.
So
right.
The Bible would have the answer to his question that he's searching. This, you know, mankind search for God. It has to be based on a principle or theme, which the Bible does have, which is God's kingdom, and it would have to have an author, which we know his name is Yahweh, Jehovah, Elohim, Adonai. But the thought here is you're searching, but if you read the Bible, God says read the Bible in the anatone day and night. He will find his answer, and he can look in the concordance or different parts of the Bible to search out thoughts that he has, because I noticed, listening to him, I was in there washing dishes, and I'll use a little bleach, that he wasn't satisfied with the answers that he was getting, because there's something missing in him, and which is the truth of spirituality. He hasn't really got it, and it's not going to happen to him, boom, boom.
All right, well, let Eric respond.
Wisdom can be found in books like the Bible. St. Augustine famously heard the words of a child say, pick it up and read it. Here was a man who lived a life of, you know, not just sensual pleasure, but debauchery, and then he picked up the Bible and he had this revelation. The caller said it doesn't happen boom, boom, but many religions talk about these revelations happening boom, boom. It's sort of this idea that you go to all these places, you go on pilgrimage, you do all these spiritual practices, you read the Bible, but then you have this insight and you realize you didn't have to go anywhere.
But is this what you're saying, this spirituality that they have all at once, does accurate knowledge have something to do with emotional preference? Or is knowledge something that you have to study? Like Jesus said, this means everlasting life, taking knowledge of you, the only true God, and of the one whom you sent forth, Jesus Christ. So we have to get accurate knowledge, not emotional preference, not lighting a candle, not smelling something and thinking that we're going to get this big experience. We have to satisfy that in which way, the way we are made, because the scriptures say that faith is the assured expectation of things hoped for and the evident demonstration of the reality though not be held. So,
except, John, one of the things that the book, I think, what his book does, though, I mean, it doesn't take just Christianity or Judaism, or it's the spectrum of spiritual faiths in this world and how they approach this differently. You know, that everybody thinks their way is the way.
Well, put it this way.
Right?
Would you believe in something just on the credulity? You know, blind credulity? I mean, the archaeologists have found out what the Bible is saying is accurate, and those people that have played a role.
Some of it, not all of it.
Maybe not all of it.
Right.
Of course,
some of it.
There's always something there.
But let me let Eric.
I mean, that's an interesting question, because, you know, when you talk about religion, the question of truth often comes up.
Absolutely.
John, right. Wait just a second, John.
But I sort of I admittedly skirt this question in my book, because the caller is adamant, and I believe that he believes that the Bible is the truth, that there is this one truth. But, of course, all these other religions I've encountered are equally adamant that they have the truth. And to bring it back to my friend William James, he once famously said, truth is what works, which is a remarkable statement. It seems kind of absurd if you think about it, the way we define truth. You know, if I said, well, 2 + 2 = 5, that works for me, that's true. No, that's not what William James meant. I think what he meant is, if these religious practices, whether it's meditation or prayer or whatever it is, works for you, and by works I mean it makes you happier, it makes you more giving, more likely to volunteer, a better person in every sense of the word, then William James would say, then that practice is true. And that's why I think too often when we talk about religion, we forget that and we get caught up in creation myths, as some would say, or creation truths, as others would say, and we look at the value of a religion in terms of whether its creation myth is true or not. And if it's true, then we assume that the religion is true, and if it's not, then it isn't. And, you know, you think that the Raelians have a silly creation myth that we were created by aliens. Admittedly, a bit out there. But people tell me they find, especially my atheist friends, they find every religion, every creation myth, basically just as wacky. Now, does that mean that there's no value in it? No. I think that what I am interested in is not religion as a path to the truth to explain to me how the world was created. I don't know. I don't know if anyone knows. But rather, religion as a kind of applied philosophy. What's the wisdom? You know, how should I raise my daughter? How should I? What should I do when I'm feeling depressed? How can I get through the day a little bit wiser and a little bit happier? And you know, maybe this is a selective reading of religion on my part, but this is my approach.
John, thanks for the call. I appreciate you being with us. I mean, when as you make this sojourn, I mean, one of the things I want to know what you found that tied some things together for you as you tried to do in the epilogue. You know, when you met the Taoists, which I found a really interesting chapter to me.
They're great. They're hard to pin down.
The Taoists.
Right, exactly.
because the way is, I mean, that's, you could spend another 2 days, 3 days, a lifetime.
Right.
Yeah. But with the Taoist or the Buddhist on the one hand, and then the monotheists, like the mystical monotheists, whether they are Franciscan thinkers or the Sufis or the Kabbalists, which was a very interesting chapter as well, that you did the end of the book, kind of for your coming home. What was the thread that tied them together for you? Was there a thread you found?
That's a really good question because they're very different on the one hand. And I don't buy into this notion that all religions are the same. They may end up in the same place, but they're very different roads. So on the one hand, they're very different. If I were to say there is one thing that they all have in common, it's an emphasis on humility, on the idea that we cannot do this all our own, that there is something bigger than us. Whether that is God or Allah or the Buddha mind, they all requires a degree of faith that we can't do it on our own. And there's a great little anecdote I use in the beginning of the book from a Hindu sage, and he said we live our lives like a passenger on a train, and we're carrying this really heavy suitcase on our head while we're riding inside the train. And the Hindu sage says, put the bag down. You know, you're burdening yourself unnecessarily. The train doesn't care whether you put the bag on your head or on the ground. And it's so simple. But that requires, you know, a kind of humility, a sense that I don't need to hold this suitcase on my head the entire time. And I've yet to encounter a religious tradition that didn't have this emphasis on humility.
I wonder if you found a connection between both your books. I mean, I was thinking about your old book that you know, it's you went to Iceland, you went to Bhutan, essentially atheist country, it's Lutheran, but a lot of atheists to a Buddhist country like Bhutan, looking for this where happiness was important, and here you kind of wrestle a lot with suffering and even ask the question somewhere like, why must God hurt so much?
Right.
You know,
which
essentially.
Well, I guess in both cases, whether it's a search for happiness or for God, it requires a sort of lack of self-awareness, a losing of the self.
Was that what you were trying to do, you think?
Well, I think so on some level because, you know, the Sufis have this wonderful story about nothingness, and I don't have time to get into it, but it's the idea that we want to achieve nothingness, no thingness. And, of course, that terrifies us because we are constantly latching onto our identities as radio show host, as author, as husband, as neurotic, whatever, you know, because those can be negative attachments too. But these religious traditions teach that we need to sort of feel like we're a piece of dust. That's what the Sufis say, which sounds terribly depressing to me, but they find great glory in that and great bliss in that. And the countries I went to searching for happiness, they didn't really think about happiness all that much, at least not on a personal level in Iceland, say. They were sort of too busy being happy. And that's the sort of thing about spiritual seeking. For some people, it can become sort of a substitute for living in a way, and this is difficult to explain, but if you know what I mean, it's instead of focusing on the end result, you know, instead of focusing on your destination, you just become a map collector instead. So you become fixated on maps and you don't go anywhere. And that can happen to people too, especially book people such as myself.
And you end the book, other than the epilogue, with your trip to the Kabbalists, speaking of books.
Right.
And Jews being always known as the people of the book. And you being raised as a Jew. And going to that, but into this ancient kind of mystical
right.
setting, which is very different than...
Well, this was the hardest chapter to write, to be honest, because here I was returning to the faith that I haven't been particularly faithful to. I have not been a practicing Jew most of my life. But I wanted to find a sliver of Judaism that would appeal to me, and for me that was Kabbalah. And like most people, I had a sort of one-word knowledge of Kabbalah, which was Madonna, basically.
Right.
This is so many people would say that to me. But there's a lot more to it than that.
A lot.
And I don't pretend to fully understand it, but I tell you that the appeal to me is that it is essentially a heart-based approach to Judaism as opposed to head-based. And it's very much about intuition. About the heart, very similar to Sufism in a lot of ways.
And Buddhism in some ways.
And Buddhism. So I sort of, at the end of the book, I go on this walking meditation in the woods outside of Tzfat. I met this man named David Friedman, formerly an ultra-Orthodox Jew, now describes himself as an ultra-paradox Jew. And he welcomes the Jewish Sabbath, not by going to a synagogue, but by going for a walk in the woods, a slow meditative walk. Now, is that a Buddhist practice or is that a Jewish practice? For David, it is both.
I mean, the man is credited with founding Hasidism. Baal Shem Tov, that's what he used to do.
And he was a mystic.
He was a mystic.
And he was a Kabbalist.
You liked mystics. You liked something about the mystics appeal to you.
It just seems like, in a way, a shortcut, which appeals to me because you're sort of bypassing your brain. And on some level, it just makes sense. The irrationality of it makes sense. If, boy, does that make sense? Or is that
no,
sounds confusing?
Sense.
And I think if, you know, it's the difference between, you know, taking classes on how to taste wine and studying wine or just having one sip of a really nice Pinot Noir. You know, it's that direct experience. The Sufis have an expression, he who tastes knows. It's the idea of tasting something as opposed to just blathering on and on about it or studying it endlessly. Because I don't know anyone who has just thought their way to bliss, whether it's the more secular kind of happiness or the more spiritual kind of bliss that we're talking about here. I mean, if book knowledge were all it took to be really blissed out, college campuses would be just filled with blissed out PhDs. And they are, unfortunately, not. So
it takes forever to get a PhD.
Right.
Eric Weiner, the book is Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. This was
good to have you here. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our interns are Sienna Greaves, Morgan Barber, Manifa Wilson, and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. With the podcast of Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. For the home of the 2016 Baltimore Mayoral Debate, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Have a great weekend. Take care.